Preface. There have been millions of words written on the subject of branding, but they nearly all relate to consumer products and markets. This is hardly surprising in the light of the megabucks spent on brands by firms like Coca-Cola, Intel, McDonald's and Levi's. However, for most managers of businesses, the strategies of the branding gurus are as remote as the sums of money which the big brands spend on advertising. A manufacturer of printing presses in Manchester, a foundry in Birmingham or an office equipment supplier in London will find little relevance in the branding theories because they're not written with them in mind. This book is written for managers whose customers are other businesses. Their products or their services are not consumed in the high street, but are bought by other companies to help in their own output. This is the field of industrial and business-to-business marketing. Companies start small and they grow big. They're created because someone had a good idea for a service or a product. Companies are built up by people who know how to make good products or services, but who may not give much thought to the longer-term implications of their branding. The term branding and its link with consumer marketing may be thought by some industrial managers to be a frivolous subject, concerned with creating the illusion that a product is better than it really is. There is some truth in this. Branding can make customers think better of a good product or service, but it does not compensate for deficiencies in quality or design. This book has been written to show that branding is as appropriate for a company pressing metal pieces as it is for Pepsi-Cola. It will work for a manufacturer of industrial hose just as it does for Honda. In fact, branding is working already for industrial companies, but not with the efficiency that it could. Many industrial companies have customers they have supplied for years. These loyal customers buy more than products. They buy trust, friendship, reliability, and any number of other intangibles which have a value. Few buyers would change their supplier just because someone knocks on their door offering the same goods for 10% less. The premium which a product enjoys over and above its commodity price is directly attributable to the benefits the customer believes that they obtain as a result of buying from that product. That difference lies in branding. Where industrial companies are already benefiting from branding, it is often by accident rather than design. However, with a little extra effort and cost, the effect could be much improved. With better branding will come increased business, improved loyalty and greater profitability. I have no intention of overclaiming. Branding is certainly not everything which underpins a successful business. Branding is not the whole of marketing. In fact, branding is just one aspect of marketing. But if a company gets its branding right, the likelihood is that all the other parts of the marketing mix will fall into place. Branding is the thread which runs through the book, and marketing is the subject which surrounds it. Also, many other business functions determine success: efficient production, innovation, training, financial control, and other aspects of good management are all vital. But above all, there is a need for a commitment to quality, both product and service quality. Everyone engaged in a business must have this commitment, but for the marketing director or manager, it needs to be a passion. Some believe that quality issues ought to account for a third of a marketeer's time. Branding may increase the success of a product, but without continual maintenance of quality standards and a continuous search for improvement, the foundations rest in sand and long-term failure is assured. I've come to this subject as a practitioner in marketing, a market researcher to be precise, where I've worked on industrial subjects for over 30 years. I'm not an academic. The theory of marketing has to work in practice, and so it is without shame that I've written this book from my experiences. I will have done my job properly if, from time to time, the reader nods and says, yes, this is only common sense. The book is in 5 parts. It begins by examining the way in which people buy industrial products. This is the starting point for any consideration of branding. Section 2 then moves on to discuss what branding is and the role it has to play in industrial marketing. In the 3rd part of the book, I focus on understanding brands and see how to take them apart and measure what is happening. With this background, in section 4, I talk about how brands can be built in industrial markets. The book concludes with 3 chapters in section 5 about brand management, including how to place a monetary value on them. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the people who've made this book possible. The first book I wrote on this subject was with my long-time colleague, Peter Jackson. Much of the contribution from Peter is retained in this edition, because what he said is insightful and as true today as when he first put pen to paper nearly 20 years ago. I would also like to thank Matt Powell, a colleague who works with me today, for enlivening the text with appropriate graphics and diagrams. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the many managers in industry that I've worked with over the years and who really do try to market their companies and build sustainable brands. If through their inspiration, others begin to apply branding in their own companies, the result will be an increased competitiveness and a more cheerful face to industry. Chapter 1. How do people buy industrial products? Characteristics of industrial markets. We begin this book with a discussion on how people in businesses buy products and services. This understanding of the buying process is crucial to the main theme of the book, which is the role played by branding in the purchasing decision. As we shall see, the purchasing of industrial products is considerably more complicated than that of consumer products, and for this reason, a strong brand can simplify the process. Let's face it, if I trust a company, either because of its reputation or I've tried it before, it makes the buying decision easier. Industrial products are not sold on the shelves of supermarkets, so I have to spend time and effort working out which companies I want to do business with. Branding's going to help me do this, even though I may loathe admitting it. The starting point for this journey into industrial branding is to understand the wide variety of products that we're talking about. Every time a householder buys a loaf of bread, a bottle of perfume, a new coat or a car, their action sends waves back down the chain, creating a demand for flour and grain, chemicals, textiles, steel and a host of other products and services which are used in their manufacture. This chain, with one product deriving its demand from that for another, is responsible for every business being dependent for its livelihood on some other business. It is called the chain of derived demand. As with all chains, acceleration or deceleration at the end can become magnified as the reaction moves backwards down the line. Consumers can adjust their buying patterns more rapidly than the industrial firms in the chain. Businesses require lengthy lead times to commission new plant in response to an increase in demand. And equally, they cannot readily shed labour to react to a temporary fall in sales. Similarly, a rise or fall in consumer sales triggers off a chain reaction, a stocking or destocking out of all proportion to final demand. At the end of the chain, consumers buy finished products in the high street. These products are given memorable brand names, packaged brightly, and advertising and promotion build the demand. Back down the chain, the consumer is ignorant of the materials and processes which have gone into the products that they have bought. Except for rare examples, consumers leave the selection of the suppliers of the materials to the companies which make the products they buy. There's no insistence from you or me, the final consumer, that the car we buy should have steel from a certain manufacturer, seats from another, a starter motor from another. Whatever Ford, BMW or Saab think is what we accept. But if the totality of the car is not to our liking, we'll buy somebody else's, thank you. Consumers indirectly affect the choice of materials which go into final products through voting with their wallets, not by specifying the materials from which they should be made. Industrial markets and the wide variety of products. Consider for a moment the products which people buy for themselves and their households. Foodstuffs, leisure products, home and garden, the car, travel, finance. Within each of these areas, there are many subsets of products and services. In food alone, we have a variety of products including confectionery, fresh vegetables, canned foods, drinks and so on. Within canned foods, there are vegetables, soups, fish, puddings, etc. Companies making consumer products tend to specialise in one of these areas. For example, Campbell's is a food company specialising in tinned foods. Levi is a clothing company specialising in leisure wear. Honda is a vehicle manufacturer specialising in cars and motorbikes. There are a wide variety of consumer products and thousands of manufacturers, but they're nothing compared with their industrial counterparts. Whereas the householder usually buys a finished product, the industrial buyer often buys a component. The power station is made up of hundreds of thousands of purchasing decisions before it is completed. Some by the manufacturers of the gas plant, the manufacturers of the motors, through to the manufacturers of the screws which hold things together. How different these products are. Commodities such as fuel, metals, chemicals, timber, sugar, cement. Components range from bricks and tiles to plastic parts, cables, steel pressings, filters and sub-assemblies such as motors, switchgear and pumps. Capital goods include office machinery, earth-moving equipment, trucks, cranes, process plant. Industrial services include plumbing, legal, financial, transport and distribution. Pick up a directory of industrial products and you will find thousands and thousands of different types of products listed. The government classifies industrial products and services in a special listing known as the Standard Industrial Classification, or SIC. This has headings for engineering, packaging, construction, transport, business, and financial services, and so on. Every type of product and business is included, with detailed subdivisions within each heading. Mechanical engineering, for example, is broken down into industrial plant and steelwork, tools, engines, compressors, heating and ventilating, pumps and valves, etc., etc. It is this large range of products and services that give industrial markets their complexity, so that the marketing approach for steelworks is likely to be different to that of an office equipment supplier selling copiers, faxes and computers. Their approach will certainly be different to a company marketing goods and services to high street consumers. The complexity of the industrial buying decision. There is another dimension which distinguishes industrial and consumer markets. Most grocery purchases are made by one person, and two may get involved when they're major items of expenditure on furniture, cars, and houses. But in industrial markets, the buying decision is much more complicated. An engineer may specify a certain component required for a process. A production manager may have to ratify the decision, and a buyer may have the authority to choose an appropriate supplier. Other people could have some sway, including the finance director who controls the budget and the person on the shop floor who has to use the product. The interaction of the different personalities in the buying team will mean that the buying decisions vary considerably from company to company. In the smallest of firms, run by the proprietor, all these decisions are rolled into one, while in larger companies there could be numerous layers in the buying process. The rational industrial buyer. There have been several studies which have shown that consumers in the high street choose a brand not only for its functional benefits but also to reflect their own self-image. As an extreme example, consumers use brands as symbolic devices which in part express their personality. Gucci handbags, Rolex watches, are easily understood examples of this phenomenon. The functional qualities of the Gucci handbag or the Rolex are almost certainly relatively low, although the consumer may not admit to this. The customers of each of these products already have other handbags and watches, but this does not stop them making another expensive purchase. These products are bought by people so that they can benefit from the statements they believe they will confer upon them. Functionality is in second place. Tippex correcting fluid, on the other hand, was a strongly branded industrial product, and yet it would only be bought by someone who required it for its functional use. Tippex, the correcting fluid, would not bestow any secondary benefits on the purchase, such as making a statement about their personality. It might even suggest that they are a poor typist, although they may feel comfortable in the knowledge that it is being made by a reputable company. In industrial markets, products are purchased because people need them, and not because they want them. This leads people to assume that industrial buyers would buy any product as long as it is functional. It also implies that whatever is purchased is likely to be based on more objectivity than consumer purchases, which are full of emotive appeal. Intuitively, it seems to make sense that the business-to-business buyer is more rational than the consumer counterpart. As we shall see, this is true, but only up to a point. Business-to-business buyers do have a greater propensity to rationalise their purchasing decisions, and this is to be expected, as they are employed to obtain the best deals for their companies. It would be an admission of failure, incompetence and sheer idleness to say that they are less than perfectly informed about all the sources available to them. To be fair, buyers are likely to know a lot about their main supplier. They may know a good deal about their secondary and tertiary suppliers, but they cannot be assumed to know anywhere near as much about the huge array of other companies that could supply their products. And if they don't know everything about all the suppliers, it cannot be a perfect market, and it cannot be assumed that the choice of suppliers is the best. Nor should we forget that emotional influences play a part in industrial buying decisions, just as they do in purchases for the home. People do not become automats as soon as they come to work. They're still influenced by non-rational considerations. Buyers are courted by suppliers. They're made to feel important. The sales teams are always talking to them and visiting them, and a relationship is built up. Small gifts are handed out. Jackets are given away with the supplier's logo discreetly printed on the pocket. At Christmas, there's a special lunch or a dinner to celebrate the successful partnership. Visits take place to the supplier's works to see the product being made, perhaps with an overnight stay, so that the deal can be informally discussed over dinner. It is inevitable that this wooing has an influence, and that it colours the objectivity of any decision. Also, whatever buyers may say, they are influenced by how a supplier is presented through advertising, sales brochures, and in personal contact. Multiple sourcing in industrial markets. Buyers of industrial products usually buy from more suppliers than is necessary. Two suppliers may be justified on the grounds that each will keep the other on its toes, but sometimes there are four, five, or more used for the same goods. This proliferation in number of suppliers happens over time. There is always someone new tempting the buyer, and in a moment of weakness or as a genuine attempt to buy more efficiently, a new supplier is added. The opposite of this has occurred in the automotive industry, where suppliers are regarded as partners, delivering components of a high quality to a tight timetable. Working with a small number of suppliers has resulted in improved quality control and a reduction in prices, as the volumes given to the successful companies allow them to achieve better economies of scale. This process of vendor rationalisation and just-in-time deliveries is widely adopted in mass manufacturing businesses, where there are massive savings to be made in costs and improvements in quality. It is clear that for some businesses, multiple sourcing is not the answer. And yet, smaller companies use a profusion of suppliers. Electrical contractors continue to buy from half a dozen wholesalers. Printers use four or five paper suppliers. Sometimes this taps into the specialisation of the different electrical wholesalers or the paper companies, but more often it is a legacy which has never been addressed, and it reflects inefficiencies in buying. Three factors which influence most industrial buying decisions. Three factors crop up time and again as critical influences on the industrial buying decision: quality, price, and delivery. Inevitably, this is a gross oversimplification, as each of these terms could be unravelled in some detail. Embedded in the term quality are a number of elements. Depending on the industrial sector and the products in question, these include reliability, durability, strength, longevity, power, finish, and engineering integrity. Also, the term quality in industrial markets is often used in the sense of fit for purpose. Some products can fail because they're more than fit for purpose. They're over-engineered. The machine tools produced in the UK have a reputation for longevity. They can easily last 25 years or more. However, rapid changes in technology may mean that companies buying machine tools don't want them to last more than 10 years, because in that time they will be obsolete. There may be no value in paying for something which will never be used in over-engineered products. A Taiwanese machine tool could offer perfectly acceptable quality for the period that it will be used, at a more attractive price. Ask a buyer in the automotive industry what they look for from their suppliers, and inevitably keen prices will be mentioned. Automotive buyers are masters at shaving fractions of a euro off the many thousands of components they buy in their efforts to get prices as low as possible. Superficially, it appears that the key requirement is price, but this misrepresents the true picture. A buyer at Ford will not buy a component at any price. The supplier has to prove that it has installed rigorous quality control procedures and that his products comply with Ford's exacting quality requirements. Unless the supplier passes the quality screen and demonstrates that it can meet the just-in-time conditions of delivery, he will not be able to begin discussions on price. A road haulier may weigh the lower price of an Iveco truck against its faster depreciation and a lifetime cost which exceeds that of a Volvo or a Scania truck. A company that insists on being paid in 28 days could prove to be more expensive than one that allows 2 months credit when everything is balanced out. The term delivery is also made up of a number of aspects. Delivery to some means off-the-shelf availability. To others, it is the speed with which the product or service can be brought to the door. What matters to most buyers is the knowledge that a product will be delivered at the time promised. It does not necessarily mean the ability to deliver at a moment's notice. It is the understanding of the subtleties that is all important in successful marketing. What exactly is required in terms of quality, price, and delivery? Which is most important and which is least important? How do buyers trade these different factors off one against the other when they're selecting a supplier? There are many other factors. Of course, service is increasingly important in distinguishing companies, and it's been estimated by the consultancy firm McKinsey that it accounts for between 10 and 20% of all manufactured products. This could be so when you consider the purchase of a product includes service prior to delivery, technical service, and setting up at the time of delivery, and the after-sales service and guarantee. This leads us to the all-important question: where does branding come into the buying decision? If this book is an advocate of branding, how come branding isn't pivotal in the decision? The problem is that buyers of industrial products seldom admit to branding influencing more than 5% of their decision. In one respect, a brand is just a name to signify who made the product. In another respect, the brand or name of the manufacturer summarizes all the values which are on offer: quality, price, delivery, the lot. Inertia and trust and their role in the buying decision. Quality, price, and service are vital, But in practice, there is one overriding issue which is seldom mentioned as a reason for choosing a company. That is, because we've always bought from that company. Just consider the number of years people in industry have used the same companies as their main suppliers. It's not unusual for a supplier to have been used for 5, 10, or even 20 years. The buying inertia in industrial markets is still further evidence of the lack of rationality in the buying decision. In pressing home this point, I'm in danger of making buyers seem unprofessional, failing in their duty to constantly check prices, delivery, and quality differences between alternative suppliers. In fact, buyers are only doing what any sane and sensible person does, and that is hanging on to a good thing once they've found it. They've got to know a supplier, and all their requirements are being met, so why change? Again, this brings us back to branding, because it's not just any supplier that's been used again and again, it's that special one, the tried and trusted brand. All deals are struck at some stage for the first time. On that occasion, negotiations take place on price, delivery, payment terms, all those aspects which buyers tell us are important. And from time to time, prices and terms are renegotiated as the buyer works to ensure that the deal is acceptable, and perhaps also to reassure everyone, including himself, that he's doing his job correctly. But for a company that's happy with a supplier, which has been used for many years, these issues, which are renegotiated, are relatively small because, in the larger scheme of things, changing an established supplier for a new one carries a real risk. The formulators of paints for cars mix a variety of standard chemicals, which can be purchased from a number of large chemical companies. The chemical components are relatively inexpensive, and in a recessionary environment, their prices are driven ever downwards. However, to change, the supply of a hydroxyl acrylic monomer, a standard component in the formulation, for a saving of just a few cents off the price, isn't worth it. The new product would have to be tested to ensure that it performs as well as the previous monomer. And in any case, the buyer knows that all suppliers have to keep within a sensible pricing band, for otherwise, they'll certainly get left behind. Buyers in industry learn from experience which products work. They learn to trust certain products and their suppliers. Such is the trust that they fear the consequences of dropping one supplier and using another. The other supplier may promise better performance, offer a better financial deal, and they say that they can deliver quicker. But they would say that, wouldn't they? Will the prices be raised in a few months? What will happen if the quality does not live up to its claimed performance? It's easy to promise delivery dates, even to keep the first few, but can they keep it up? Skeptical that everyone is likely to make such claims just to get their foot in the door, buyers often reject the daily door knockers out of hand. Consideration sets. A buyer of heavy trucks in the UK can choose from a list of 12 different marks. These include trucks made in Sweden, Germany, France, Italy, Holland, Japan. It needn't really stop there. They could seek out American or Spanish trucks, which are all available to a limited extent in the British market. In practice, the buyer of trucks draws up a shortlist, which may comprise just two or three trucks, the ones which he trusts, the ones which he thinks fit his purchasing criteria. This is his consideration set, the products he's prepared to consider. Trucks within the consideration set have to compete strongly to win the sale, while those outside are not in the running. Getting into the consideration set is the first part of the marketing task for industrial companies. The first requirement is to be known to the buyer. A company which is unknown has no position in the buyer's mind, and since most buyers have plenty of products available to them with which they're very familiar, there's no incentive to learn more about a new one. A company wanting to buy a plant to make industrial gases would have a limited choice of suppliers. In Europe, there are three major players. The British-German combination of BOC and Linde. Air Products, a British operation but with an American parent. And Air Liquide, a French company. A German company wanting to buy a gas production plant would almost certainly place Linde in the consideration set. Would probably enter the final negotiations with one other party, as much as anything to ensure that Linde offered the best deal. Japanese gas separation plant suppliers would not enter the frame, and almost certainly a German buyer would not even know their names. A Russian plant manufacturer may be known by name, but a lack of knowledge about their reliability and service support could stop it getting into this consideration set. The predilection for supporting a domestic supplier exists throughout the world in many industrial markets because there's an emotional predisposition favouring the indigenous company. Commodities and differentiated products. In simplifying our understanding of the conglomeration of industrial markets and buying situations, it can be helpful to classify companies into those which sell relatively simple products made to a standard from those which sell complex products, each one of which is clearly different. The products made to a standard are akin to commodities. The product characteristics are always the same within a similar class, and it wouldn't matter which company supplied it as the features and performance are similar. In these circumstances, quality is a given and the spotlight is thrown onto other variables, the two most important of which are price and delivery. If one such product goes into short supply, so the price will rise and conversely gluts forced prices down. In true commodity exchanges, where wheat and iron ore and cocoa are bought and sold, prices dip and rise with changes in supply and demand. A few notches up from these simple raw materials are processed goods such as chemicals, cable, steel, cement. In each case, there are standards governing the quality of their manufacture, and the chances are that each supplier is able to offer approximately the same delivery. In these circumstances, so very common in industrial markets, the onus falls on price. At the other end of the spectrum are products which are quite different one from the other. The quality standards and the features which are designed into these differentiated products are determined by the manufacturers, and each one targets his offering against certain groups of buyers. The service which supports such products before and after sale is also likely to vary amongst manufacturers of these differentiated products. As the term suggests, differentiations set the products apart. Photocopiers within a class may print at the same speed, but the models on offer from the different suppliers could vary in fundamental ways such as their size, shape, and design concept. There could be different features, including automatic collation, stapling, double-sided copying, programming possibilities, and the like. Within the same class, these machines purport to do the same thing, but buyers can recognise that they achieve it in very different ways. Such differentiation would be even more pronounced if we were to consider printing machines, packaging machines, or steel mills. Branding at work in a commodity market. In commodity markets, small differences in price give a buyer a justification to change a supplier. Discounts of just 1 or 2% can swing the order. A small savings per ton can amount to large sums over a year if thousands of tons are purchased. Where products are noticeably different and the standards are entirely those of the manufacturers which make them, buyers have many more reasons for selecting one product in preference to another. And so other issues come to the fore, particularly the product's performance, quality and durability. Let's for a minute think about companies that sell electrical cable, the type that's used for wiring houses. Cable is made to a standard, so that it will be roughly the same for each manufacturer. Let's also assume that each manufacturer charges the same price, which is 100 units per reel. Assuming that all had the same distribution, we would expect that the law of economics would mean that each would end up with a 10% share. Now, the demand for unbranded electrical cable is price elastic. That is, a small drop in price from one supplier would result in a large increase in demand for that cheaper product. Assume that for every 1% drop in price, the share of a supplier increases by 2%. Similarly, a 1% increase in price would cause a manufacturer to lose 2% of its market share. One of the cable suppliers, and we'll call it Company A, decides to raise its prices by 10% to 110. As a result, Company A's market share falls from 10% to 8%. A fall in demand of 20%. Dissatisfied with the loss of business, Company A decides to return price to 100 units and try another tack. Company A now searches for some means of offering something extra to customers. The cable pack is redesigned, and the reel is enclosed in a visually distinctive box. The new pack is strongly promoted, with an emphasis on point-of-sale material, and a well-thought-out marketing program ensures that the whole wholesaler network accept that the new pack and buy in adequate stocks. The new pack offers some handling benefits to both contractors and wholesalers, but the major change is improved communication of the brand. The launch proves to be a success, with the market share for reel-in-a-box climbing steadily to 40%. Business is taken off each competitor in equal amounts. In an attempt to win back their share, the other cable manufacturers reduce their prices by 10 units, expecting that this will do the trick. In fact, this does not happen, as wholesalers and contractors have now a strong commitment to the branded cable. Branding and differentiation work for reel in a box. Summary of Chapter 1. Industrial and business-to-business marketing is concerned with goods and services which are bought by businesses for use in their factories or offices. Demand for all these products is pulled through from the consumption of products by consumers, resulting in a chain of industries stretching back to raw materials. The variety of industrial products is enormous. A feature of industrial markets is an often complex buying decision involving many managers within a firm. The order placed by a buyer may be the culmination of a lengthy and a complex process. Compared to consumer markets, the purchasing of industrial products meets largely functional needs, and arguably, decisions are more rational. However, non-rational and even irrational factors also shape industrial purchasing. Historically, industrial buyers have multi-sourced their requirements. However, this approach has changed, with a greater emphasis on building a partnership with a just one or two smaller number of suppliers. The major motivators in supplier choice are quality, price, and delivery, although each of these factors is complex, encompassing various issues which can be critical to the buying decision. Once suppliers gain business, there is a strong influence of inertia. Buyers tend to buy from suppliers they know and they trust. Often just a few suppliers are considered at all. Those are the buyers which are included in the consideration set. Industrial products lie on a spectrum that ranges from undifferentiated commodities at one end through to complex equipment offering unique design features at the other. Products towards the commodity end are typically traded on price, with business won through undercutting competitors. Branding offers a different and a more profitable marketing approach and can transform a commodity into a differentiated and a customer-requested product.